inquiry into public debates and policy for building a more just and equitable Canada. In this excerpt from a new episode of new segment Social Democrats of the North, host Dave McGrain in Saskatoon explains how from the 1919 Winnipeg General Strike to the birth of the Canadian Commonwealth Federation in 1932, J.S. Woodsworth became a pioneer of Canadian social democracy. Now, here's the show.
His reasons for entering politics were solid. He wanted to put his ideals into action. He wanted to implement enduring, long-lasting, and systematic changes to Canadian society that would finally eliminate the poverty of the working class. Hi, and welcome to episode 5 of season 1 of Social Democrats of the North, presented by the Broadman Institute's Perspectives Journal podcast series. I'm your host, Dave McGrain, a professor of political science at St. Thomas More College at the University of Saskatchewan, and a member of the Perspectives Journal's editorial committee. In the last episode, we looked at Frances Marion Benon, the feminist firebrand from Manitoba. In this episode, we are going to continue to talk about Manitoba by examining the life and the ideas of a politician who was the first social democrat to become well-known across Canada. I'm talking about the first leader of the CCF, the party that eventually became the NDP, James Schaefer Woodsworth, better known as J.S. Woodsworth. Woodsworth was born into a relatively wealthy family near Etobicoke, Ontario in 1874. His father, also named James, was a Methodist minister. In 1882, Woodsworth's father took him and his family on a great adventure to become Christian missionaries in the Canadian West. They traveled by train, steamboat, and wagon all the way to Portage-la-Prairie, Manitoba, where Woodsworth's father took up a post as the local Methodist minister. The Woodsworth family eventually settled in Brandon, where young J.S. experienced life on the Western Canadian frontier and often accompanied his father to remote farms across the province of Manitoba. Woodsworth's father passed on to him a religious zeal and a strong Christian faith. Following his father's footsteps, Woodsworth was ordained as a Methodist minister in 1896. He spent some time preaching in the various parts of Manitoba and became known as a person of great integrity who thought more about the well-being of others than the well-being of himself. In 1899, he decided to further his education by studying theology and philosophy in Oxford, England. The 3 years that Woodsworth spent in Oxford in his mid-20s proved to be a turning point in his life. While living in England, he witnessed firsthand the terrible poverty and wretched living conditions of London's working-class neighborhoods. Woodsworth had always had an unshakable faith in the goodness and the grace of God. How then, he asked, could God allow for such poverty to exist? The man of faith was starting to have a crisis of faith. Woodsworth returned in 1902 and was appointed to head up a Methodist congregation in Winnipeg. But the poverty that Woodsworth found in Winnipeg was as bad or even worse than what he had experienced in England. At the time, Winnipeg was growing into a large metropolis that was the gateway to Western Canada, and its economy was dominated by the transportation of goods and a large manufacturing sector. Immigrants from Central and Eastern Europe, as well as the United States, flooded into the city. However, the business owners of Winnipeg took advantage of the situation to pocket huge profits for themselves while paying starvation wages to these new immigrants. And most of these new immigrants did not even speak English, and many of them did not enjoy the protection of a union. No matter how much he thought about it, Woodsworth couldn't understand why his church was always concentrating so much on the individual salvation of its members. People were going hungry and lacked adequate shelter, clothing, and education. But all his church ever told anyone to do was to pray daily and go to church on Sunday so they could get to heaven. Woodsworth's deeply held beliefs and ideals were telling him that he needed to do something to relieve the misery of the poor in Winnipeg, but he was not sure that the Methodist Church was the place to do it. In fact, Woodsworth prepared his resignation letter as a Methodist minister several times, even though he was dissuaded from submitting it by his friends and his fellow ministers. To get out of this dilemma, Woodsworth began to contribute to the development of what was called the social gospel at the time. The social gospel was an influential doctrine in many Protestant congregations in English Canada in the early 1900s. Woodsworth and other social gospelers, as they were often called, argued that Christians should not just sit around all day and pray. Rather, they should become involved in politics and seek the realization of the kingdom of God on earth by championing the achievement of social and economic justice within their local communities. Like other social gospelers, Woodsworth saw Jesus' teaching and Jesus' life as being in line with social democratic principles. After all, Jesus definitely did not act like a big businessman during his time on earth. Jesus was born in poverty in a manger, was a worker himself, a carpenter, cared for the poor, lived communally with his apostles, and died in poverty after having been persecuted by the rich and powerful who feared his message of radical social change. Therefore, Wordsworth began to preach that being a radical socialist was actually a way to follow Jesus' examples and to be a good Christian. To live out the social gospel in a very real and substantive way, Wordsworth moved into the role of social worker when he took over the leadership of the All People's Mission in 1909. Under Wordsworth's leadership, the All People's Mission became an important organization providing the basics of life for the poor immigrants and working class families who lived in Winnipeg's North End. However, it should be known that Wordsworth did promote some racist stereotypes of certain ethnic groups as being less intelligent and less civilized than British Canadians. In particular, he called for the creation of programs to ensure that immigrants from Eastern Europe and Central Europe quickly learned English upon their arrival, and he called for the Canadianization of immigrants, forcing them to adopt what he believed were superior British Canadian standards of education, dress, and conduct. For about a decade, Wordsworth was happily preaching the social gospel on Sundays and working amongst Winnipeg's poor during the weekdays. He even moved his young family into the mission, and his wife and his children helped him in his efforts to reduce the poverty and hardship of all those who passed through the mission's doors. However, pressures were building that would take his life in another direction. Wordsworth was starting to feel that social work was just a band-aid solution. He was providing immediate relief to the poorest of the poor in Winnipeg, but he was not participating in finding more systematic and long-term solutions to the wealth inequality caused by the capitalist economic system. Second, Wordsworth's superiors were getting tired of what they considered to be his radical social democratic and social gospel ideas. And they were particularly angry that he openly opposed the conscription of young working class men to fight and die overseas in World War I. They asked Wordsworth to tone it down and just stick to preaching the simple message of pray lots and you will get to heaven. They wanted to silence his voice so that his message of radical social democratic change would no longer be heard. The easy way out would have been for Wordsworth to just shut his mouth and do what he was told. But he was the kind of person who wanted to stay faithful to his ideals, no matter what the consequences. So in 1918, Wordsworth officially resigned as a Methodist minister, and his bosses gratefully accepted his resignation. Now he had his ideals, but he had no money and no job. In his job as a preacher and a social worker, Wordsworth had always helped the working class. But he was not a working class guy himself. He never got his hands dirty, and he never did 10 hours of labor a day. Nonetheless, he left his family in Winnipeg and moved to Vancouver to become a manual laborer on the city's docks at the age of 44. He joined the Longshoremen's Union, helped organize the Federated Labor Party of British Columbia, and wrote for the local labor paper. In 1919, he was sent on a speaking tour of Western Canada by his union. As described earlier, Winnipeg in the early 1900s was characterized by the horrible poverty of workers alongside the opulent wealth of rich businessmen. The bosses in Winnipeg's rich part of town were feasting on champagne and caviar. The resentment of the workers of Winnipeg concerning their treatment by their bosses was boiling over when Wordsworth got into town. Along with various other labor leaders, Wordsworth began to organize what is probably the most famous strike in Canadian history, the Winnipeg General Strike of 1919. During the strike, the city was essentially shut down when workers walked off their jobs to protest low wages and poor working conditions. The strike only ended when the federal government sent in the RCMP and two strikers were killed on what became known as Bloody Sunday. After the strike ended, Wordsworth was imprisoned for writing statements during the strike that authorities claimed could lead to revolution and the overthrow of the Canadian government. Ridiculously, one of the statements cited by the government as potentially leading towards revolution was simply a verse from the Bible that appeared in one of the newspaper articles wrote by Wordsworth. The Bible verse went, "Woe unto them that decree unrighteous decrees," Isaiah 10:1. Imagine being thrown in jail for quoting the Bible. That's exactly what happened to Woodsworth. He was eventually released on bail, but the charges against him were still pending. Coming out of the strike must have been a low point for Woodsworth. His ideals were intact, but he had lost his job as a minister, and he was now considered to be a criminal in the eyes of the government. Again, Woodsworth could have maybe been excused here for giving up on his ideals and trying to find a way to quietly rebuild his life and provide for his family. But as you probably already guessed, this is not what he did. He decided to fight the charges against him in court and went on a speaking tour to denounce the government's treatment of workers during the strike. After succeeding in getting the charges against him dropped, he decided to get into what is probably the most unstable employment in the world. He decided to become an elected politician. His reasons for entering politics were solid. He wanted to put his ideals into action. He wanted to implement enduring, long-lasting, and systematic changes to Canadian society that would finally eliminate the poverty of the working class. He wanted to get Canada closer to realizing the social gospel's dream of establishing the kingdom of heaven on earth. The time for praying was over. It was now time for action. But his success as a politician was by no means a sure thing. Woodsworth obviously did not want to run as a liberal candidate or a conservative candidate, and those parties would have probably not accepted him anyway. He had to run as a social democrat, and in 1920, almost no social democrat had ever been elected to public office in the history of Canada. Woodsworth was undeterred, and he joined in the creation of the Manitoba Independent Labour Party. It was called the Independent Labour Party because it was a party for the working class that was independent of the two traditional parties in Canada, the Liberals and the Conservatives. The party's slogan was straightforward, but maybe not all that catchy. Human needs before property rights. Against all odds, Woodsworth was elected in Winnipeg North Centre in 1921, with many of the workers who had gone on strike 2 years earlier voting in favour of him. With the exception of William Irvine, who we'll examine in a future podcast, no other Labour candidate was successfully elected in the 1921 federal election. So Woodsworth became part of a Labour caucus of two MPs out of 235 MPs in the House of Commons. Nonetheless, it was during the 1920s that Woodsworth grew in fame and became the first social democrat to be well known throughout Canada. There are a couple reasons for Woodsworth's rise to national prominence. The first reason has to do with the arc of Canadian history up until the 1920s. There had been no genuine Labour candidates elected in the House of Commons prior to the 1920s. And it was very rare for Social Democrats to be elected in lower levels of government as well. Therefore, there was a novelty about Woodsworth, and the media turned to him as a spokesperson for the labour movement that was growing in strength in Canada during the 1920s. For instance, in 1921, Maclean's, which was the most popular news magazine in Canada, commissioned Woodsworth to write an article simply entitled, "What Does Radical Labour Want?" There was also an element of luck, the second reason Woodsworth grew in prominence in the 1920s. Canadian federal elections in the 1920s had a habit of producing a configuration in the House of Commons where the Liberals, under Mackenzie King, were just a couple seats short of a majority government. Woodsworth succeeded in getting reelected several times during the 1920s, and the number of Social Democrats and Labour candidates gained elected grew slightly, though they never numbered more than 10 MPs. Woodsworth ended up being the informal leader of the Social Democratic Caucus in the House of Commons in the 1920s that became known as the Ginger Group. Even though he was in charge of a caucus with very few MPs, Woodsworth was able to use the minority government situation to his advantage. In exchange for the support of his MPs to keep the Liberal minority government afloat, Woodsworth was able to bargain with Prime Minister Mackenzie King for the advancement of legislation that created new social programs to reduce the poverty of the working class. The most notable example came in 1926, when King and the Liberals were facing almost certain defeat in the House of Commons if they did not get the support of Woodsworth and his Ginger Group. In a letter, Woodsworth demanded that King pass legislation to create both old age pensions and unemployment insurance in exchange for the Ginger Group's support in the House of Commons. Woodsworth was then invited to meet with King for supper at his official residence. He was once again faced with the choice between following his ideals and taking the easy way out. After supper at the Prime Minister's residence, King ushered Woodsworth into an elegant room with beautiful oak paneling and plush chairs. In fact, you can still visit that room if you're in Ottawa and go to the Laurier House National Historical Site. In that posh setting, Keynes offered Wordsworth the position of the Minister of Labour in his cabinet, as well as a vague promise to create legislation on old age pensions. Getting Wordsworth into cabinet would have definitely been very beneficial to Prime Minister Keynes, because that would mean they would no longer have to worry about his government being defeated in the House of Commons and his Liberals could stay in power. Accepting the cabinet position was certainly the easy way out for Wordsworth to take. Only 7 years ago, Wordsworth had been out of work and in jail for the role that he had played in the Winnipeg General Strike. Becoming the federal labor minister would have given him considerable political prestige and maybe even would have given him the opportunity to make some progress on old age pensions. But it was also clear to Wordsworth that he would be selling out his social democratic ideals by joining a liberal government he had criticized vehemently for not doing nearly enough to reduce the poverty of the working class. And by joining Keynes' cabinet, Wordsworth would lose any bargaining power in the future to force the liberals to pass left-wing legislation. So Wordsworth immediately refused Keynes' offer. He stuck with his social democratic ideals, and it turned out to be a good choice.
It was a highlight from a recent episode of the Perspectives podcast. Find out more at perspectivesjournal.ca, at broadbentinstitute.ca, and at harbingermedianetwork.com. You listen to Harbinger showcasing your local campus and community radio station. I'm Harbinger director Andre Goulet in Montreal. And finally, broadcasting for more than four decades, Red Eye presents a progressive take on current events produced by an independent media collective at Vancouver Co-op Radio. On the segment from a recent episode, Dalhousie University professor and Indigenous Peoples Health Canada research chair Debbie Martin argues that the rush for Indigenous identity policies at universities has led to people with legitimate claims to indigeneity being swept up in policies that cause harm. Now, here's the show.
I'm Jane Williams. This is the Red Eye Podcast. You can hear our live broadcast on Saturday mornings from 10 till noon at 100.5 FM in the Lower Mainland. On the podcast today, Professor Debbie Martin of Dalhousie on who gets harmed in the rush for Indigenous identity policies at universities. The practice of people self-identifying as Indigenous has come into sharp focus after a number of high-profile cases of pretendians claiming to be Indigenous without evidence. However, far less attention has been given to Indigenous people wrongly labeled as pretendians. In a recent article for Policy Options, Debbie Martin argues that the rush for Indigenous identity policies at universities has led to people with legitimate claims to indigeneity being swept up in policies that will cause lasting harm. Debbie Martin is Inuk and a member of Nunatuchabut. She's a professor in the School of Health and Human Performance at Dalhousie University and the Canada Research Chair in Indigenous Peoples' Health and Well-being. And she joins me this morning from Halifax. Hello, Debbie.
Hi, good morning, Jane. Thanks for having me.
It's a real pleasure to have you on the show today. In your article, you say that your university is one of several that's moving too fast in its efforts to create policies that will deal with the issue of pretendians. What did Dalhousie do to address this issue?
I think there's been sort of a race, I guess, between universities to come up with policies that would address what I think is a very intractable issue within Indigenous communities and within university settings as well, to determine who is and who is not Indigenous. And I think this has come as a result of the identification of some individuals who've been identified as what is, I guess, colloquially termed pretendians, or people who are claiming to be Indigenous but do not have proof to back up their claims. And so because this has happened within universities, there's been a fairly strong group of Indigenous faculty, staff, and scholars within those institutions that have indicated that there needs to be something beyond the idea of self-identification at universities. And so what's happened is that universities have taken on this role. I think a lot of them have committed to addressing the calls to action that came out of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that specifically address education. And they want to do good. They want to, respond to communities and respond to Indigenous concerns around the Indigenous identity policies. But in doing so, I think that they've jumped the gun and rushed towards implementing policies that have actually, in fact, hurt Indigenous peoples that are working at those institutions or studying as students at those institutions. And so in the case of Dalhousie, for instance, what's happened is that there were a group of individuals that were tasked with creating a report that resulted from consultations that occurred within Mi'kma'ki. That's here in Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, and Prince Edward Island. And the result of that report included recommendations on how to address and go beyond the issue of self-identification.
The report was critiqued by two Mi'kmaq legal scholars from Dalhousie Schulich School of Law. What did they say about that report by Dalhousie?
Yes, when it came to the attention of Naomi Metallic and Cheryl Simon, they took a human rights lens to the report, and they decided that some of the concerns that they had warranted sort of a rebuttal of the proposed identity policy at Dalhousie. And in their report, I think they used the phrase, it was too blunt an instrument to actually deal with the issue of Indigenous identity. They highlighted a number of concerns in their report, most of which were around the idea that when we are using verification systems that rely on federal verification, we're ignoring the self-determination of Indigenous communities to determine who is and who is not Indigenous. And I think that fundamentally means that there are many Indigenous communities and groups of people and individuals even who are faculty, staff, and students at various institutions across the country, Dalhousie being one of them, who don't fall within state-sanctioned federal verification, but whose lineages, their family ties, their cultural connections are all very much indisputably connected to Indigenous communities across Canada.
So who gets left out?
Well, I think there's a number of people that get left out, and I think Naomi and Cheryl did a great job pointing out who those individuals are. One of them would be, for example, Indigenous peoples that were part of the 60s scoop, where they were adopted out of Indigenous families and raised in non-Indigenous families. And many have had a lot of trouble, I guess, reconnecting back to their birth families. And so those people are very much Indigenous, but the means to prove that is made very difficult by sealed records and difficulties connecting with those families and finding out exactly who their family connections are. And so, that's one example. I think there are other examples of Indigenous collectives across the country. Nunatu'avut, which is the community that I'm from, is one example of those, where even though we have federal acknowledgement of the fact that we have the historical rootedness and the cultural connections, the genealogical roots that determine that our families and our ancestors were very much Indigenous and that we are Inuk and Inuit, we are left out of that because we do not have federal recognition at this time.
Is there, in fact, any kind of easy mechanism to distinguish between a pretendian and someone who is Indigenous?
The easy answer to that is no, I don't think there is. I think the issue is incredibly intractable. I don't think there's a way to determine this. I think one of the concerning things that I see is the rise of other Indigenous communities and organizations that are unwilling to acknowledge that their neighbors and friends and sometimes cousins are in fact Indigenous. And so there's organizational politics at play that prevent one Indigenous organization from receiving the support and encouragement and acknowledgement of other Indigenous organizations to identify as Indigenous. So there's a lot of lateral politics, I think, that goes into determining who is and who is not Indigenous. And that plays out when we start to see universities reaching out to Indigenous communities to actually ask the question of who is and who is not Indigenous. But, I don't think you can look at somebody and tell that they are. I don't even think blood quantum is a good measure to determine if someone is or is not Indigenous. I think it has a lot to do with community connection, family connections, rootedness, and your kin acknowledging that you are part of that community. And so I feel like that is not something that should rest in the hands of academic institutions to determine.
You mentioned Nunatuchobut, and you're a member of Nunatuchobut, which represents 6,000 self-identifying Inuit in South and Central Labrador. What did Memorial University say about Nunatuchobut earlier this year?
So Memorial University undertook a similar process that was also undertaken here at Dalhousie University in that they did consultation sessions. I participated in one of those as an alum of Memorial. And in those consultation sessions, they wanted to sort of ask questions around what constitutes an Indigenous person within the province of Newfoundland and Labrador. They hired an external consulting group to do that work. The external consulting group produced an interim report that was released. It was released to the public for comment. And when I read that report, I felt as though my voice and the voice of many of the people that are from Nunatuchobut was entirely erased from the report, in the sense that they were recommending that Nunatuchobut not be included by nature of the fact that our neighbors, Nunatsiavut government, had indicated that unless a group has federal recognition and or their neighbors acknowledge them as such, that they should not receive a status at a university as Indigenous. And so for me, that was incredibly concerning, because we know that there's a whole series of politics, I guess, between Nunatsiavut and Nunatuchobut. But we do know that there's brothers and sisters, some of whom are Nunatuchobut and some of whom are Nunatsiavut. And yet that politics is playing out now at the university level.
I want to go to the University of Saskatchewan now, because they commissioned a report 3 years ago and they listed some red flags to help figure out, they said, if someone is pretendian. What were some of the issues that they identified?
Yeah, so when I read their report, it was one of the first actually that had come out after universities really started.
A new interview from Red Eye. Hear more of their high-quality public affairs and arts programming every Saturday from 10 to noon, PST at CFRO 100.5 FM in Vancouver and at HarbingerMediaNetwork.com. You've been listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. This episode's been brought to you by Unrigged. Learn more about Canada's coalition of more than 30 progressive publishers. You get all your independent Canadian journalism, including news, videos, and podcasts, in one place at unrigged.ca. Follow us on Instagram and Blue Sky for updates on new episodes, and subscribe to the Harbinger newsletter for weekly Wednesday roundup from Canada's cross-country community of 83 socially and politically progressive podcasts. We're taking a little holiday break, but we'll be back with all new weekly episodes starting January 13th. Until then, I'm Harbinger Director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Now, back to your regularly scheduled community radio station programming.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. We hope you have a joyful Hanukkah and a Happy New Year.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Many municipalities want to cut carbon pollution and prepare for climate change. But of the nearly 200 local governments in the Cincinnati area, only three have a detailed plan to do so. Van Sullivan is with Green Umbrella, a regional climate collaborative that's working to change that. They say a lack of resources and bandwidth is often to blame. Many towns have a small staff to handle everything from budgets to snow removal. So Green Umbrella created the 25 Communities Project. It provides 25 cities and towns with training, funding, and technical support to cut emissions and prepare for climate impacts,
so that the local government doesn't feel like they have to do this work alone.
To boost capacity, participating communities can be paired with a student fellow who will work for 3 months to help them advance their goals. And the initiative will bring the communities together so they can share ideas and partner on projects. Sullivan says the goal is to create a collaborative regional network of local governments ready to tackle climate challenges.
The issues being faced by the communities are similar, and so it's about not only creating individual plans, but creating a culture of climate planning and collaboration that can move forward for years to come.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.